Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning. Today's tax reform day. We're going to look at a couple of more long-term issues in Senate Bill 925 and 567. But before we do that, we're going to go into a work session on three bills here. So let's start at Pacific Wonderland and open up a work session on Senate Bill 472. Mazen, maybe you could re-brief us.
I was being courteous. I was going to have it out and moving before you even got across the room, but
I have to catch up with no huddle offense. So the Senate bill, this is the Pacific Wonderland extension bill and also expansion. Remember this at a certain time was allowed at 40,000 plates. Now this bill pushes it another 40,000 and allows for this to be the $100 upfront, and then sends that money to the Capital Foundation at 50% and 50% to the Historic Society, and allows the Capital Foundation to do with it in their general program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SB 7 or 472 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 472 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. We're trying to raise supply to meet demand. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, 472 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Edwards, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. We are not going to hear Senate Bill 924. The sponsor is not quite ready yet, so we'll carry that over to another day. And I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 864.
Chair, I move the A3 amendment is into SB 864, and then I'll speak to the motion. Action, Osmo.
Senator Boquist moves that the dash 3s be amended into the Senate Bill 864. Discussion? Did you want to explain?
Mr. Chair, the amendment, the 863, I mean the dash 3 amendment, this was part of the, as we try to fix this bill, what we're trying to do is to make specific that both the natural resource credit that you are able to take against the estate taxes on your estate tax in Oregon, that is Oregon based, Oregon specific, so both the natural resource property segment and the base that you take the proportion against is also the Oregon property. So we try to fix both the numerator and denominator in the quotient and the proportion in order to make that natural resource credit applicable to the within state estates.
Further discussion on the dash threes? Senator Bertschinger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Has anyone talked to the sponsor of the bill to make sure that this date of January 1, 2015 is correct?
In writing, yes.
We have?
Yes, okay. In writing. Yes, it's fine.
Okay.
No further discussion on the dash 3 amendment. Any objections? Seeing none, the dash 3s are adopted. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 864 as adopted with the A3s to the floor with the due pass. And I'll speak to the motion.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 864 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist.
There's about three or four actual sponsors on this bill. If you recall, colleagues, primarily its intent is to fix the cross-border contiguous state issue of natural resource bases when places like Klamath County, Malheur County, even up in Multnomah County, so on and so forth, sort of trying to bring it in line with what we thought it was going to be. And I'm sure that Senator Witzert is more than happy to carry this bill. Been told so.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Senate Bill 864, as amended, goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Whitsitt will be the carrier. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2493. It was carried over from yesterday. We didn't have the paperwork in. We do now. Do we need a...
Yes, we do. Committee Amendment A3, right? Mr. Chair, I move the A3 into the primary bill, which is House Bill 24.
Well, I was going to say, do we need a rebrief on that?
If you would like, Mr. Chair, the 2493 is... primarily the bill that dealt with the Debt Advisory Commission. This changed the A3 changes the time horizon of their meeting, and also the forecast in the original bill, or the as it reached you. The bill was specifying a long term. The A3 makes it more specific as to be at least 6 years, and then to be consistent with the revenue forecast of the Department of Administrative Services.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 into House Bill 2493A.
Senator Boquist moves the A3s into House Bill 2493. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2493 as amended with the A3 to the floor with a due pass, and then I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2493 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, colleagues. If you just recall, what were the A3 and the intent here is to match up the state debt policy advisory information and forecast with that we normally have in the revenue forecast, which falls under the Department of Administrative Services, which really falls to the state economist offices. We're simply matching the language across the board so it's consistent.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. House Bill 2493 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation. Senator Riley, we're back up to you. Would you carry this bill?
Of course.
Riley will be the carrier. So that clears out our votes, and we're going to take a look at some tax reform scenarios here with Dr. Warner. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 925. And the purpose of this committee is to look at some computer modeling that Paul and his staff and his team put together for us to think about as we try and straighten out not just the Swiss Alps, but the
Grand Canyons
and the landscape that cratered property tax landscape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, one of the activities that we pass our time with during the interim is to work on our models, and Christine and Chris have done a lot of work on updating our OTIM model, so we have some simulations using the updated version. Just a little history and background on OTIM. OTIM was actually authorized by the 99 legislature. We got it done in 2001. It was the product of work from our office and Oregon State University and Washington State University. So we produced a model of the Oregon economy. It's what's called a CGE model, a computable general equilibrium model. It's a long-term model. It's not a forecasting model. And what it does is it's really designed to see how the capacity of our economy will change given major changes in tax policy. So the key factors behind the capacity for the Oregon economy is labor and capital. So we look at what response we get primarily in our labor markets, our capital markets, in response to changes in tax policy. A key factor in those results is the in-migration we get, or out-migration. So we have, and that of course affects the labor supply, affects demand in the system. And then the the net return to capital is a key variable because capital is assumed to be highly mobile across borders. So we treat Oregon's economy, it's really a two-region economy. It has Oregon and then the rest of the world. The Oregon's exporters are assumed to be price takers in the rest of the world, meaning they don't have market power. Domestically, they compete with one another, and that can be reflected in their prices and shifts within the Oregon economy. So we produced a couple of results, a couple of simulations for you. Basically, what we're trying to do is just give you a sense of kind of the overall results we get from the model, kind of the trade-offs. And I've always thought this is one of the real strengths of OTIM. It does highlight for you the trade-offs in different major economic policies. And we put together a couple of simulations, both of which are designed to be revenue neutral. So to give you a sense of what we think in a static sense would be revenue neutral. So if we scored them in our normal way, looking at our tax calculator and the income tax and property tax data and so forth, these would roughly score out to be a net wash or revenue neutral. So if you look at the first simulation we have up there, this one would have a reduction in income tax rates. And from our current system of 5.7, 9, and 9.9, we would go to a 4.6.8 system. So we'd reduce those marginal income tax rates. And we would to offset the revenue loss associated with that, just for purposes of looking at the interactions, we put in a 1.5% tax on the value added at each sector level. So value added in terms of how it would be calculated theoretically, you can do it two ways. You can do what's called the income method, where you would sum up the income associated with a particular business, and that would come from generated by wages, by rent, by interest on capital. So it would be the return to all of those factors. It would exclude anything that's purchased from another business. Typically, the way the Europeans do it is they take your total gross receipts and then they subtract out all your invoices, purchases from other business. So that would be an administrative issue. But again, the idea here is to show you how a broad-based consumption tax would interact with a personal income tax rate in terms of its impact on the economy. So if you look at the first box there, you can see where those results are. And we end up with a higher equilibrium in terms of personal income. It goes up almost exactly 1%. That personal income is $166.6 billion. We would estimate it would be $168.3 billion after the economy adjusts to these changes. Just let me say a little bit about that adjustment. This is a long-run model. It's actually what we call a comparative static model. We have a system now that's at rest. We shock that system, and then it comes to rest at another place. In terms of real time, we just assume that's about 5 years. If we're in a recession, for example, we think that'd probably be longer because your economy would be adjusting more slowly because of excess capacity.
Okay, just to keep following you, Paul, we're lowering the income taxes from 5.79 to 4.68, and we're adding a value-added tax of 1.5%. Are you talking retail, wholesale?
The value-added tax would be paid, and I've got copies here if anybody needs a copy of these.
Looking at the top box.
Yeah. There's one on each side. So I'm looking at the one that has reduced personal income tax rates to 4, 6, and 8 and establish a value-added tax. So the way you impose a value-added tax, would be paid by the business based on the value added. Now, typically, and we did a lot of work on this concept back in 2001, we called at that time the BAT. You may recall the BAT, the Business Activity Tax, which was a value-added tax. And basically, at that time, we had a mock-up return, and that return would be based on the sum. It would be the same, exact same information you have on your tax return now, but you'd be adding them up differently. You'd add up your wages, your interest, your rent. It would be those factors of production. And so you'd add those up. That would become the value added by your business, and that would be that's what you would multiply by 1.5% to get the tax.
Okay.
So that again,
that's what we've changed to, and the computer shows what this top line personal income. People have more money in their pockets.
Yes, that's total. It's the personal income is really a measure of the overall economy. So what we're saying is that after a 5-year adjustment period, that the economy would come to rest at a higher level of economic activity. And as I said earlier, I think the best way to think of it is we're saying the capacity of the economy would be greater. And you can see the reasons for that. You would have, under this scenario, more jobs. There'd be about 64,000 more jobs, about a 2.68% higher level of employment.
And what is that attributed to, the increase in jobs?
Well, the increase in jobs is there's an interaction that goes on, but the driving factor behind it is you have an increase in both the demand for labor and the supply of labor. It's actually the supply of labor that generates that change. When you reduce those marginal income tax rates, you have an increase in the supply of labor. That's because the after-tax wage rate goes up. So you've got an increase in the supply of labor. So what that does is it drives down the gross wage or the before-tax wage. So businesses see a lower cost of labor, so they hire more people. And as they hire more people, that increased demand for labor draws more labor into the economy, both from internal sources, people that now are working because of the higher return, and also those that come into the state through migration. Okay. So you can see the population there goes up by about 66,000, and the jobs go up by about 64,000. So you've got a combination of both internal labor force adjustment and people coming from outside the state. And that people coming from outside the state then further fuels demand for labor, and particularly in the service sectors.
No, I remember seeing this when we had the sales tax modeling, but the number of jobs wasn't as high as it is here. This is a pretty significant increase in employment.
Yes.
With this change.
Yes, we've had typically when we've run these
digesting right now.
He's digesting. It's it's pretty rich.
Yes, it is.
There's a lot here, yes. When we run these scenarios with consumption tax versus income tax, this is a result we've consistently gotten, that you do see when the system adjusts, and this is not to say you're not going to get gains in all sectors because there will be adjustments within the economy, but once the economy adjusts, you'll have a higher level of employment as a result of this shift. And basically what that's saying is that an income tax has a more distorting effect on regional economic activity than a consumption tax does. And I think that's pretty standard theory.
More distorting effect. Can you
right. It discourages economic activity more than a consumption tax does. People don't move into a state because of a higher or lower consumption tax.
But they do because?
Because of income taxes and the return to labor and capital.
So that's the primary reason for the...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's labor and capital that drives it. When you lower the income tax, you've increased the rate of return on both labor and capital.
So
and then they both respond. And you can see that, for example, the return to capital is up by about 1.5%, and then you have an increase in the investment of about $72
million. Oh, yeah. So jobs are up, investment is up. But you're putting on a 1.5% tax that wasn't there before on business. Is there a downside in your modeling to that?
Yes, that interacts and has what we're saying is there's a downside to that. And if we were just to look at that in isolation, we would have a reduction in economic activity.
Uh-huh, right.
But we're saying that's offset by the lower personal income tax rates.
Okay.
So that's why we're looking at this statically revenue neutral trade-off. Now this wage result too is a common one for us, and that's always confusing for people. Well, how come people are willing to work more with lower wages? And the answer is again because the take-home pay is higher. They're looking at their after-tax wage. So that's where you get that wedge for a worker is the gross wage minus the taxes on that wage, income. And you can see that the price level drops a little bit. Typically, with a retail sales tax, we get a higher price level. But with a value-added tax, what we're saying is the downside for businesses would be those that are exporting would end up competitively be affected by this. But the model's saying that the offsetting benefits from the lower income tax rates help them offset that.
Senator Riley?
Yeah, wouldn't it, I'm not an economist, obviously, but it seems to me that what we're talking about in more people going to work because of the lower income tax, wouldn't it probably be the lower income tax, then more people going to work, and then wages going adjusting to more people in the workforce? So that would be the progression, most likely?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
Because people see it, well, in that immediately after the tax change, then people now are getting a higher wage.
Mm-hmm.
And then that,
right.
as the market responds, some of that gets bid away because of the increase in supply of labor.
Right. Thank
and
you.
That's where businesses benefit from the lower gross wage. So that gives you those private sector. And I just, you know, one of the things we wrestled with is how best to kind of summarize these results. There's a large number of sectors in the OTIM model, so there's a lot of potential deeper analysis that can be done in each of these major proposals. But these are just the overall aggregate levels. If you look at the public sector, the state spending is up, and you have an increase in overall revenue as a result of this. And that revenue increase is really summarized in the two little boxes below the big box. The static revenue estimate, as I said earlier, was zero. And the dynamic effect is $220 million. So you have a result that's statically neutral, but you get a revenue gain. And, of course, that revenue gain is associated with the increase in economic activity.
So the average, does that mean that average taxes will not go up, but because more people are here and more people are working, that's the increase?
Yes. So the state
more taxpayers.
Or the state and local governments capture that additional economic activity. And you can see, actually, in this case, a lot of it goes to the local governments because of that in-migration driving up property tax values and property tax revenue through increased residential property and also capital investment.
Senator Bartsugger.
So, Paul, obviously I'm going to have some questions down the road after this sinks in a little bit.
We're not voting to
digest the crab cakes and the Godiva chocolate.
Right. But the question I have today is if we decided to go this direction, what would you think the transition period, because the transition period is going to be bumpy, there's no question about it. How long is that transition period going to be, do you think?
I think you're absolutely right, Senator. And you know, and that is one of the major obstacles to any kind of major tax reform,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, the practical reality is that no matter how bad your system is, people, investors, businesses, and individuals have made decisions based on that old system. And so some of those decisions aren't going to make sense anymore if you change the system dramatically. So that would be an adjustment period. Our model says 5 years, but, you know, it's I think it does depend on a lot of things that would be going on. Depends on where the state of the national economy is. If we're in a growing national economy, you could probably make that a transition more quickly. If it's in a down economy, probably less so. So that is a key factor. The other issues around administrative issues. Economists and generally theoretically like the value-added tax because of its theoretical strengths. It's doesn't have the stacking effect that a gross receipts tax or that it doesn't have some of the negatives associated around the retail sales tax, which is a lot of retail sales taxes on business, and that has a distorting effect, particularly if it's a 6 or 7% rate. But there's a whole set of administrative issues for a state to come in and introduce a tax that, frankly, we don't see anywhere in the country. We've seen that Michigan has operated the single business tax for a long period of time. They've gone away from it. The only example we have now of a value-added type tax is the BET in New Hampshire, which is the business enterprise tax. And they're kind of an anomaly because they don't have an income tax or a sales tax. So they use it as a kind of a complement to their corporate profits tax. So, you know, that would be a whole set of administrative issues. It could be done, but I think the key issue would be how that affects exporting businesses. And that was really the result that came when we really took a serious look at this in the past, is how that would be, how would businesses respond to that, to a tax that only Oregon basically imposed. So, but we do have, in terms of the model, the ability to look at what about really four levels of consumption tax we've talked about. The retail sales tax, and we can vary the base on that, making it more narrow or more broad. We can do the gross receipts tax, something like the commercial activity tax that you talked about. And we can do either one of those or this value-added type tax.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Just for the sake of jumping from the frying pan into the fire, for the three members who are now drinking from the fire hose while the chair and I are just thinking about what's going to happen next. One thing we all need to keep in mind is the reason we have not had significant tax reform is that the legislature has to do all of it in a package, and many of it a lot of it may require a vote of the people, but only the legislature can refer all the simultaneous changes to the people to say this is what it would look like, this is what the future's like. You can't do it by initiative because of the single source issue. So at some point in history, if we're going to make the Grand Canyon go away, the legislature as a whole has to figure out what does that package look like, and then really say, okay, people, here's what the package is. What do you want to do? So I don't think any of these get looked at in isolation, but the problem is, or the theory is, in order to fix it, to fix the Grand Canyon, which we need to fix the Grand Canyon, is it's going to take the legislature making the recommendation to the people for the plan. Because as we all know, people aren't going to vote for a sales tax for the 10th time if there isn't another plan. They don't, for some reason, they don't trust politicians. I don't know why, but they just don't.
Well, theoretically, if we just did this, it's not a vote. It's not a statewide vote. It's just change of statutes. The legislature could just do it. I don't even know if this is a majority vote. Is this a 3/5 vote?
I think council probably would interpret it that way, but you could argue that, you know, make a case that it isn't if it has a static
revenue neutral.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I think they would tend to, because of the magnitudes, they would probably take a very close look at it. I will have to say that OTEM doesn't help you with these political questions.
What are the chances?
It's not the oracle. That
actually,
can,
it does.
Yes. Well, yeah, well, no, it does. Good data is definitely helpful.
Yeah. The second big piece of an OTIM run is the second half year box there, and this, of course, is the other piece that we did. We back and when we constructed OTIM, we got a lot of help from the California Department of Finance. Bruce Smith, the late Bruce Smith, was there, and he had developed a model for California called the DRAM, and he really helped us set the parameters and the equations and so forth, and for OTIM, the economic part of it. But the thing that DRAM didn't do was go through the tax incidence and look at how it affects different levels of income. So that was one of the things we thought was really important to add into OTIM. So we've done that. We take instead of going to quintiles, we take from the household income data comes from a merge from Department of Revenue's income tax data and property tax data. And that's, if you want to know how Christine spent her interim, that was how she became a familiar figure over Department of Revenue, trying to merge those data sets. And that's the big lift for us in terms of effort. But we've got a new base. We've reset that base. And you can see the income groups. Now, I will emphasize these income groups are not the same size. Mm-hmm. They vary in size. So just to keep that in mind as you look at it. We thought it would be more helpful for you as policymakers to look at these different levels and get a real sense of how it
Well, it's
things.
Really interesting that the tax break for people making between $20,000 and $34,000 is the highest in a percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a, I think, a good selling tool. You're never going to get around the fact that the people who are making over $205,000 are going to get a considerable tax break, but that's just, mm-hmm. but by a percentage, they're down with everybody else.
They're benefiting primarily through the increased economic activity, because this is a total incidence model. So what it does is it captures not only the effects of who's paying the tax, but who's affected once prices and wages and income change. So it builds in the economic effects, and that's why that group, which is tends to be sensitive to changes in returns to labor. And also, I think this group is benefiting from the in-migration.
Wow.
You can see the number of households. The change in households is very large for that group, as the models assuming those people come into the state.
So is the summary then more disposable income at the bottom end, mm-hmm. benefits small business owners at the top end? Is that what I'm...
Yes, the top end. I mean, the top end really benefits from those lower marginal rates, because you've gone, one thing, you've got a bigger drop from measure 66, because you've gone from the 9.9 down to 8. So that's a pretty big decrease.
Yeah.
That's people with capital gains, high wage earners that work in the tech sector, for example, would be major beneficiaries of this. So that's the high income group that's benefiting.
Okay.
And we do find that this group, now here we've got some in-migration, but if we really target things like capital gains, for example, this group can be sensitive to migration. We actually have our migration equations are by income group, and the highest income group is the highest mobility factor.
So, another question. So, those migration equations, have those been, how often have those been tested? And what did we see after 66 and 67? Because there was a lot of discussion about that before, mm-hmm. 66 and 67. And I can never remember which one was which, 66 or 67.
66 was the one that had the 9.9%
66,
rate.
Okay.
And there was a lot of discussion initially, because we did see a big drop in capital gains income.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've looked at that afterwards, in the years since then, that big drop was primarily caused by the Great Recession,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't any bigger drop than for the typical state.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't think that 66 generated a lot of out-migration, perhaps some.
Mm-hmm.
We do see, when we look at IRS data, that Oregon is a net gainer in terms of in-migration for all of the income groups up to 200,000, but above 200,000, we do experience over time,
mm-hmm.
we've experienced net out migration from that group.
Mm-hmm.
Now that could be a factor, could be a series of factors involved there, but one could conceivably be mm-hmm. under the tax system. So that gives you kind of a sense of what you can look at.
A follow-up question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I just got to thinking about other factors. So, did those consider the demographic distribution? I mean, somebody in their sunset years is going to make different decisions.
Absolutely.
At different income levels than somebody in their 30s at different income levels. And does it take into account those type of factors?
The model takes into account, it does have demographic factors in it, but it has equations that are based on historical migration patterns for those income groups. So that's what drives the model. In terms of, detailed empirical analysis on movement, yes, that's a big factor. And things like family connections and age of household, those are significant factors in location decisions. And in most cases, more significant than taxes.
Right.
That's been the national finding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We then ran another scenario. We're trying to kind of put some of the big pieces in there that you've discussed. And this one is another revenue neutral proposal. We did kind of half of the discussion we've had around the personal income tax, but we wanted to try to run one that doesn't have a consumption tax. So we we kept the rates in place. So you'd have current law rates, but you'd have a bigger standard deduction. So you actually you have a bigger standard deduction, and you disconnect from Schedule A. So you get a big revenue gain from disconnecting from Schedule A. You offset some of that with an increase in the standard deduction. So there's more of a bigger zero bracket amount, but you're keeping that 5 through 9.9 bracket structure. And then you use that additional revenue from the Schedule A disconnect to put in a $100,000 homestead exemption. So, and that would be on assessed value. So that means that, of course, that's going to be a bigger proportional reduction in taxes for lower income people, because they're going to be lower valued homeowners, to be more accurate.
So income taxes are going to go way up.
Income taxes go up and property taxes go down.
Yeah.
So that's the combination.
Would you need a statewide vote for the homestead exemption?
You would not, Mr. Chair, because it's, you know, the thing about Measure 5 and 50, they're limits. Mm-hmm. So those limits could still be in effect. So you would just have, you can always go below the permanent rate, for example.
Well, what surprises me about this modeling then is income taxes go up, but if I'm reading this right, jobs go up too.
Yes.
Even though the reason they went up in the last model, in the last example you had, was because of a reduction in income taxes.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think the driving factor here and the job growth is the migration that comes in, that comes in as a result of the lower cost of housing. And that pushes, you can see you get an increase in population of 54,000, and you get a smaller increase in employment than you would get in the previous example. But you still, with an increase in the labor supply, and it's particularly at the lower end with this bigger standard deduction, you're going to get a decrease in, you're going to get an increase in the return to labor for that lower income group, because they've got more than doubling of their standard deduction. So you're going to have a lot more people that are zeroed out in terms of the personal income tax.
Right.
So again, you get the big gains at that second lowest level income group, where you get the big percentage gains again. But unlike in the previous example, even though you do have a drop in the wage index that stimulates some additional hiring, you also get, if you look at the income distribution, you can see that the high income group actually loses in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of those rates, because they're still in place, and so they're going to be, and they're also heavy users of the itemized deductions. So they're going to lose those itemized deductions, and they're going to be still subject to those high marginal rates. So they're going to have a net loss. The other groups win because of the increased economic activity, really driven by the increase in housing. We can look at things like home ownership, what that would do in the model. So,
Senator Burchinger?
How do we keep the counties whole
in this
scenario?
Well, I see $903 million coming to the general fund.
Yes. So your dynamic revenue impact is positive, but of course, as you see, it affects the different levels of government. So, you know, for something like this, we've always thought of the homestead exemption as being paid for in a mechanism like the senior deferral, where the state would basically pay the counties or the taxing districts for that exemption, just like you do for the senior deferral.
I don't know how much the counties would want the state to have more control over the purse strings. So.
That could be interesting. Did you factor that question?
Yes, I'm sure OTIM has the answer for that too. But yes, that would be a major issue, those kinds of shifts in the level. And that would be, it's just like Measure 5. I mean, that was one of the legacies of Measure 5, is that shifting and you know, who controls school finance, and that's, as you know, has had an enormous effect.
Well, just to throw bowling tar on my Republican colleague, the other option is a statewide vote and do something with 550 or something along that line. So it's a double-edged sword. Both of them are called suicide.
Yeah.
But both of them are, once again, if you want to get rid of the, I go back to the deal where I'm not disagreeing with the chair. I'm just saying at some point, mm-hmm. you know, if you put a package together, I don't know, the people, you put a whole package together and make them vote on everything, even though we might have the authority to do 1, 3, 7, and 9, and we need them to vote on 2, 4, 6, and 10. Do we not put it all in one package and say, this is the deal? Because, once again, we've had this discussion. Let's just blunt reality, because we had the work group last time. Is you might have to turn around, pull this, figure it out, so on and so forth like that. But I think the other thing, and I don't know, Paul, question to you, is that how complex can we get in the modeling? Because, as we just said, what if we did fix the system, which means you're tampering with some property, you're tampering some this, you're doing a whole bunch of stuff. Can that all be plugged into the model and say, okay, oh, by the way, we're going to trash the corporate tax and we're going to put in a commercial activities tax in its place, and then have a model that shows us this is what it would look like if you started doing this, not saying now, like in the next biennium, if you phase it in 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. Can we model that?
Senator, yes, we can trash the corporate income tax, and we can impose an alternative base like a CAT. So that's something we could do. We don't have the built-in timing. We overlay this with some timing assumptions about this 5-year period. So, but typically, what we do in terms of that, when we actually do a revenue impact, we combine the static impact with mm-hmm. the dynamic changes, and we assume those dynamic changes occur in roughly 20% increments. The way we tie it to the state revenue forecast is OTIM has a base year to it, and OTIM, really, we look at the percentage changes from the base year, and then we would apply those percentage changes to the state forecast. So we keep that forecast baseline, and then we would apply the percentage changes to that would come out of OTIM.
I follow, Mr. Chair.
I'm even more complex than that. I'm not talking about one-off. I'm saying if we walk down and said, items 1 through 10 is what would take in property tax, income tax, corporate tax, all these 10 things, if you put these together, this is maybe the way forward. Can you plug that into a single model and tell into the OTIM and tell us, okay, this is what happens?
One summary. Instead of two summaries.
Yeah, because what we have here, is, as Senator Edwards points out, on summary 2 or on model 2 we really have an income tax issue, and then we plugged in a property tax issue into it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, can we look at it as if we had this hypothetical tax code, which is, I don't know, by the time we get done, might be 10 fairly significant changes, model it and say, this is what it's going to look like. So you could, with a straight face, look at the public and say, okay, this is the plan here. Nope, you're going to get all this across the board.
Yes, we can do that. It becomes, muddies the waters a little bit about which each increment is doing in terms of its effect, because there'd be a lot of interaction. But one of the things we've typically done with this is we've imposed the sales tax and some kind of an income tax reduction. And one of the typical effects from that is you see a big impact on lower income households and a big gain at the higher end. Well, how can you offset that? Well, you can put in something like a low income family credit, which mm-hmm. was part of Measure 1 back in 93. You could expand the earned income tax credit. So we've done those kinds of things before, and we've even had homestead exemptions with those kinds of elements in there too. So yeah, we can stack those and run them together. It just gets a little bit more difficult to determine which, you know, because they're interacting with one another, which what the effect is.
Right. For everybody watching, Dr. Warner, just so you know, we're not talking about a sales tax here. Let's get that one off.
Yes, we'll have to come up with a new term for that.
That's exactly right.
Consumption tax.
Right.
Yes, but those are the kinds of options that you can look at, and and we could also, as I said, if we look at different taxes, whether it be a CAT type tax or whether it be a corporate income tax, we can exempt certain sectors. We've got 90 sectors in the model, so we can exempt certain sectors and see how that affects things.
Oh, great.
So
not the legislators.
So hopefully that'll give you an idea what we can do, and we're happy to work with a committee to run some.
This is very good for us to chew on. I'm especially drawn to the economic activity in both of these, but especially to the value-added tax. And I think, you know, both of these are better than what we're doing now, Senator Edwards.
You, Dr. Warner, you mentioned being able to exempt certain sectors, and I was thinking about something. Could you say that again? What were you, in the modeling?
Yeah, the base for the OTIM model is something called the M plan. It's a which is a standalone model, but that's the base. It's an input output model, so it's built on the linkages of individual sectors. Agriculture mm-hmm. buys from other sectors, and mm-hmm. other sectors buy from agriculture. So it has 90 sectors, and it traces those interactions between all those sectors. So you could say, you know, sector A is not subject to this gross receipts tax, but everybody else is, that kind of thing.
Well, so as a function of law, we can apply a different you can tax framework to different sectors.
You could exempt certain sectors, just as you exempt certain things from the income tax or the property tax.
Okay.
So quick.
Senator Bogus.
So, Dr. Warner, so as example, I mean, you could go into the housing sector, right? Or to the home sales sector, the real estate sector, and exempt it out in order to.
Yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Because this is a discussion that's been had before in terms of modeling. So you could take the same models you have and go back and say, what if we went to, I call it the flat tax. I know you don't call that, Dr. Warner, but you go back to like a 6% mm-hmm. rate, a different plug-in point, a VAT, and we could model that out.
Yes. Yes, Senator, we did, you know, as I said, in this one scenario, we kind of went halfway there by disconnecting the itemized deductions, but we didn't flatten out the rate. Because in order to be revenue neutral, you would have to find another big revenue source to offset that. To something like the homestead exemption, we wanted to put that in. Right. But we could just run it on a straight flat rate, and looking at a flat rate with changing the connection point, we could look at that, yes.
So as in theoretical perspective, you could model like a 6% rate, because we've had this discussion before, at least in the work, 6% rate, a VAT, and a homestead exemption.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. and see how close you get with, and then once you're into the model, you could turn around and say, what are the important, housing and home sales is an impactor. You know, if you pull one of those out of there, what does that do? So on and mm-hmm. so forth like that.
Yes. Yes. I will say, though, that, you know, OTIM is not it's not a business cycle model or forecasting model. It's a long-run model. So to look at some of the stability questions, we have another way of looking at that. We have a kind of we can put in different combination of taxes, and based on their standard deviation of the national, on a national basis, we can show how that mix will affect the overall standard deviation of the portfolio. So we can look at the stability issue separately.
Okay.
So I will warn you, though, Mr. Chair, this can be addicting when you start to look at these.
Oh, yes. I got it.
Well,
we don't
need to
just get a copy of it on our own.
What flavor chew should we use?
The bubble gum.
We do have Wendy Johnson signed up to testify.
Okay. Did you want to testify?
Evidently the only person in the Capitol that has any interest in tax reform.
Well, Senator Edwards, I think she's smart enough. We just might do something. So she's going to get it on the record real quick. Everybody else, this will never happen.
Schedule it for a work session. And
Chair Hess, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson from the League of Oregon Cities. I am surprised that there are not more folks here. I think we all know that the system, Oregon's tax system, needs some reform. I'm here just to talk more about property tax because, as you know, cities rely on property tax. 60% of the revenue for cities is property tax. So I have submitted testimony that kind of lays out the bigger problems in Oregon's property tax system, and it's on OLIS. But we appreciate the chair, especially with your leadership on recognizing the problem with our property tax system with measures 5 and 50. Those measures have significantly hamstrung cities. The problems really vary by city. For some cities, it's the permanent rate issue. For some cities, it's compression. For some cities, it's market value versus assessed value. So there's not any easy way to fix all cities' problems. And so as Vice Chair Boquist mentioned, we can't fix it with an initiative or anything else. It has to be a legislative referral to fix the whole system. And our polling shows that voters are interested in a reform, but if it's piecemeal, there's always losers and a few winners. And so the passage likelihood is just slim to none. And so we really need comprehensive reform for the voters to be willing to pass it. And if you do comprehensive reform, there will be opportunity to have enough carrots out there, basically, and assurances to voters, and you'll have plenty of levers to adjust the various inequities to keep it revenue neutral. If we do piecemeal reform, we don't have enough levers to keep that revenue neutral. So if you take a look at my testimony, Measure 5 is 25 years old, and Measure 50 is 18 years old. So we feel like it's finally about time to take a look at those that voters are more willing to look at comprehensive reform and revising those, particularly Measure 50, because that's the measure that really has provided the most complexity. And then look on page 2, I've listed out the big problems. Permanent rate, some cities literally have no permanent rate, or it's at zero, so we need to adjust, be able cities to adjust that, and right now we can't because of Measure 50. And then if we could, maybe not. if you look at the second page, I do have assessed value. I think you're all familiar with that problem of we're stuck at the 1995 levels, and then there was a 10% reduction, and that's what our assessed value is, and that just is not working across the boards, and there are structural problems with that. There's the base year problem. Back then, we were on a five-year rotation, and so some people's property was assessed much higher because they had just finished their assessment, and some are on the lower end. So we're never able to fix that inequity from 1995. There's also differences in the type of property. There's commercial property that's assessed at assessed value, and then there's industrial property that's at real market value. So there's just lots of structural problems because of our new term of assessed value from Measure 50, and we cannot fix that without a referral. The caps are still in the law, and that's from Measure 5, and those may still work, and we understand that voters want predictability, but we also believe strongly in local control. Some cities really want, and their voters want more services, and those caps are pretty arbitrary numbers, and the voters put those in place because they thought there was going to be a sales tax at the same time, and as you know, that's never happened. So those caps really could be adjusted if the voters were educated on why those caps aren't working, or at least have local control. There's the 3% growth limit that's because of Measure 50. Again, that generally makes sense, but when you have the housing market changing crazily as it did when we had the downtimes, there is no 3% growth limit on real market value. So you had significant increases in property tax in some areas, particularly like Bend is an example, because when the housing market finally went up again, there is no limit on real market value. So those rates went up really quickly. There are levy timelines that Measure 50 had that just don't make sense on how long those levies last that we like to see revised. The whole compression thing, I don't think I have to go into any details of that. It's incredibly complex, and it has had an incentive for more districts to be created so that they can get specific money, but that makes every other district and taxing district lower. So we need to take a look at that. Number 7 on my list is all the property tax exemptions. The code is just riddled with lots of them. Some have been on the books for a long time, some not so long, but we really haven't done a look at, are we really getting a bang for the buck on those exemptions? Many of them were written as economic development tools, but we're not really seeing, but for that exemption, there wouldn't be economic development. And it's a very interesting mix of industries that we really should take a look at whether we're targeting the right industries to bring in growth. And then there's the exemptions that you talked about today, the homestead deferral program. We still don't have enough money to keep that one going for seniors and disabled. There's the homestead exemption idea. There's just lots of exemptions that could be reviewed and reformed if we did comprehensive reform. And then lastly on the list is the intangible property. We know that business would really like to get rid of that altogether. And really the only way to make sure that it's revenue neutral is to do it as part of a comprehensive reform package. And that's another carrot for business if we're able to take that off the table. When we look at comprehensive reform, I listed a few of the goals that we would want. Stability and predictability, fairness and equity, simplicity and clarity, adequacy, sustainability, and voter and local control. If we did comprehensive reform, those are the kind of the goals that we'd be looking at. The league is advocating for, but we recognize that it's incredibly complex. The bill that you have before you, Senate Bill 925, is written as a legislative report request, but has a very broad relating clause. So we would advocate for having more of a work group and dialogue with LRO in the interim so that all the players who are affected by property tax, those who receive the revenues, local governments, including cities, counties, special districts, and schools, as well as the ag community, because the taxation on ag properties has different interests than urban. There's lots of folks that would need to be at the table to really make all of these parts work, business community, of course. So we would advocate for a work group, and the league stands ready to assist with that notion.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm not chair of this committee, so I don't know exactly what the plan is moving forward, but I heard the word interim, and we don't need another. I mean, this has been going on for way too long. We've had work group after work group after work group, so maybe specifically, I don't know if there's been work groups specific to property taxes. I agree with a lot of most of what you said. In your conclusion, the things that you would like to see are impossible. You cannot get all of those things. It is not possible. So I think that there are good things to keep in mind, and we need to try to bear those things in mind and do the best that we can, but we won't get there on all of those. It's not possible. And so I just wanted to throw that out. I mean, we had a big K-12 budget vote last week, and I'm just done talking about it and kicking the can down the road. I mean, we gotta start doing stuff. So anyway, I'm agreeing with you and pushing back at the same time.
So. Dr. Warner, how many tax reform interim work groups have you been involved with?
Well, I don't know the exact count, Mr. Chair. I do remember working on Governor Roberts after Measure 5 passed, and so it dates back to at least that time. But I'm also reminded of the late Hal Hovey's comment. He wrote a state reports periodical, and one of his comment was those states with unbalanced revenue systems don't show any greater tendency to reform their systems, but they do show a greater tendency to study them. So I think that's been the case for Oregon as well.
Well, I know we've had some Blue Ribbon commissions. I've been on two of them, one by Vic Attia as the chair, one with Lane Shetterly, and then I think more recently Ginny and Lane chaired the, what was it called, the big dive or something like that. That's kind of what happened to the recommendations. They all took a dive. And the biggest problem with any of these is pushing the status quo. Mm-hmm. You can marshal an army to preserve the status quo, and that's the biggest problem here, is getting people to say we're gonna pull the trigger on something that's bold. So,
and one of the issues is to get people to understand, because we all know that voters who don't understand something vote no, and reasonably so.
And tax policy is necessarily complicated. Yep. Lots of times, that's how you build in fairness and breadth, and it gets complex. Senate Bill 611 is testament to that.
Mm-hmm. And I think Oh, sorry.
No, no, go ahead. No.
I also, I mean, to your credit, the things that you'd like to see, I mean, those are also the things that you need to see in order to get the voters to support, mm-hmm. which is why we, another reason why we haven't had, but I mean, we've got to figure out a way to get this done.
Senator Buckley.
Mr. Chair, I mean, the intriguing thing is, I mean, last session, I think many of you know, whether you like or agree or disagree with the grand bargain, the intriguing thing about that was is we met twice a week for 4 months. And the only new thing that I have now seen since that, and we talked about everything, I just want to make sure that the bargain or whatever that came out was maybe, I don't know, 10% of the discussion. I mean, we went through every single one of these. The only two new ideas that I see now that didn't get through, you know, dozens of meetings with all kinds of groups across the board is the statewide property tax. You always learn something. I didn't know we could just do a statewide property tax. That didn't even come up in that discussion. And now the commercial added tax, which was Ohio's version. Those are the two new pieces that's there. And I'm kind of with Senator Edwards here, and like, you know, maybe what we've got to do is say, here's a comprehensive plan. Here's the plus, here's the minus. And let's be blunt, and then you take the plan and run it through all the vetting groups, you know, quickly and say, this is what it looks like. What do you like? What do you don't like? And then you do the other stuff. And I'm back to the deal where I'm still in the position where I think the only way to sell, unfortunately, for better word, I'll call them, the bad pieces to the public is make sure they're voting on the good pieces at the same time, or they at least understand the good pieces and try and put one comprehensive package together and say, all right, this is the best we can do. Yes or no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't prohibit the legislature from coming back and saying, you know, this piece, that piece, so on and so forth. But I'm sort of with Senator Riley. Unless you get everybody knowing what's the plus and what's the minus, we can't convince them. I mean, the reality is the homestead exemption is being out here because the discussion is this a big chunk of change. And you go to a voter and say, oh, by the way, we're just going to give you a $1.5 billion property tax cut, right? Man. You got interest, right? People are ready to start talking about it, thinking about voting for it. But then, now what's the downside? Because we don't trust those, you know, people in the legislature.
Right. And that's really a big factor is the trust.
Right. But we are in April, and Senator Edwards is right. And, of course, we'll be here till the end of June.
And we've really got, I mean, two problem areas, the income tax problem and the cratered property tax problem. And it is kind of complicated. I mean, you will never, I just don't think you'll ever convince voters what compression is and why they need to fix it. I mean, the majority of legislature could not explain compression. Yes.
Right. But Mr. Chair, I would say that, you know, let's just say compression, we'll take an example. You might not have to explain it to them and say, okay, look, we're going to cut this $1.5 billion and we're going to do this over here. You might not have to explain it. It's like, well, we're on for this one. We're not sure what the rest of this ride is, but we're on for this one and we're voting yes. And so I think there is a mechanism. And the other thing is, you know, we got to have, I guess, a guiding light. We got to put something out there and say, do you like it or do you not like it?
I always thought that it would be helpful to have, instead of yes or no, pick the current tax system or this one. Which one do you want?
Well, and I see that.
Yeah.
And that's a way to do it. But I'm just saying, not yes or no.
But don't label it as current. Don't say this is the current. Like, you can have this or you can have this. Just pick.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're rambling on here.
Yes.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add that I don't believe there has been a comprehensive bill or anything put together for property tax. I mean, there's been plenty of work groups on tax reform generally, but we haven't tried to address all of these in one package, which is what we think we need for property tax, at least. Thank you.
Well, do we need to do anything on 567?
Mr. Chair, just going to update the committee. We are working with House members as well.
Let me close the public hearing on 925 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 567.
So, Mr. Chair, we are working on a concept we've discussed briefly in this committee, and this will work with House members. They have a bill, and we could also apply this same concept to 567. Basically, it's the notion of taking a above trend growth and capital gains tax revenue and then putting that aside in a stability fund during those periods where capital gains growth exceeds its long-term trend. So we're working on that, and we've asked for a draft from council, so we'll have that for discussion for the committee as well.
Okay, good. This is the one that puts big capital gains windfalls into a stability fund. The House is also moving forward on this front.
Yes, this is the one that's really in response to the recommendations from the Pew Center to take your volatile revenue sources and set aside a piece of those for the reserve fund.
Senator Volquist?
I just a question on what the House is doing, Mr. Warner. Are they talking about constitutional stability fund? Are we still on that? We were on that discussion at one point. If that's a better method, then
that issue is still out there, Senator. The proposal the House is working on is statutory.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bertschinger.
So, Dr. Warner, if we put all this money aside, what kind of checks and balances are we going to have in there so the legislature doesn't gobble it up? I just can't imagine a big chunk of money sitting around in this body doesn't. The temptations of this body for big chunks of money are unbelievable.
Triggers.
Senator, Mr. Chair, that always is one of the issues around reserve funds. And, you know, you address that several ways. One is, you know, what's the optimal size? And, you know, what's big enough to give you what you need in a recession, but it's not too big to be tempting. So the cap issue is important. And also the accessibility issue is important. We do have the same criteria for our two funds, the Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund. But, of course, there's an enormous difference between the two. The Rainy Day Fund has a 3/5 requirement, but it's statutory. So a notwithstanding provision gets you around that. The Education Stability Fund has these triggers in terms of employment and revenue decline, but any of those findings requires a 3/5 vote and is a constitutional requirement. So that's a lot stricter access to the Education Stability Fund than you have to the statutory Rainy Day Fund.
Thank you.
Sure. And for Senator Berger, hence my question, is it accessible constitutionally or statutory? I mean, you can create a bumper board in there and make it in a mechanism by using the constitutional side, but then it comes back to what Dr. Warner is saying is, in terms of, notice I'm saying Dr. Warner so I can blame him, versus Paul, but the issue comes down is when you reach a certain threshold, right, then you stop putting it into the Constitution or have some other mechanism, but it makes that constitutional piece, which then makes people say, we cannot use that magic word, those magic two words notwithstanding, and take the money. And so that, and that was, of course, created previously where we created the two differential funds. I think I was around for voting on many of them, and you know, one of them was, we want to be able to raid one, and the other one, we want to be able to slap our hand and say you can't have it, unless it's a real emergency. So.
Mr. Chair, just one comment too about response to Senator Boquist. There's two issues around the constitutionality. One is, of course, we always run into, when you set aside revenue, we always run into the issue around the kicker, and is that counted in the constitutional kicker provisions. So that's kind of more on the revenue side. But on the fund side, you can have a statutory source that goes into the constitutional fund.
Right.
So you could kind of get a hybrid that way. So you could always say, no, we're not going to put the money in. But once it's in there, then you're subject to the Constitution.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So,
how's our schedule?
Well, we were not, the way our schedule, we were planning, we were going to suggest not meeting on Monday.
Let me take a poll. Okay.
Senator Virgin.
Oh, you want to meet on Monday?
I don't have to get up at 3:30.
Oh, sure.
That's perfect.
we're going to give you a couple of housekeeping bills, and you can be the committee.
Well, if it just means some longer sessions in the midweek, if that's okay with the committee.
And one other thing, Mr. Chair, we've discussed, and I'll need to confirm this with our House Chair, but we're looking at Thursday to have our first meeting of the Joint Tax Credit Committee. You've got a lot of bills that have come into the Joint Committee, so mm-hmm. we thought that it's about that time. We've looked when we've started that in the past. It's usually mid to late April when you have your first meeting, and that'll give you a chance to review some of the credits that have come in. We've had Chris has really devoted a lot of time working with the policy committees. We got some additional resources to allow him to do that, and so we've had some of those committees have really put a big effort into looking at the credit. So we've got some good feedback.
And some of the committees have shown restraint
yes.
and not sent any on.
That's true.
All right.
That's true. Both.
So why don't we take off Monday and look at finishing up whatever these other bills, I think mostly technical and minor, on Tuesday and Wednesday, the tax credits on Thursday. In the meantime, I hope the committee members will take a look at this computer model and talk to your colleagues about them and your caucuses. And I want to revisit both of those models, but particularly the value-added one, as something that we can look at more seriously in the second half of this session.
One other thing, Mr. Chair, about the schedule. We are starting to get subsequent bills come in from the other committees, so those are coming in now. So anticipate some of those appearing here in the next couple of weeks. And of course, the other thing is just to remind you, we're not subject to the chamber deadlines.
Right. I wanted to raise that issue, so everybody had that correction. Yeah. And Mr. Chair, just a reminder, I think it's 9:38, which is the junior rural SIP sort of work group. After we get feedback from the county commissioners on Monday, then I'll reach back to you and we'll see if we can get a work group together.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the discussion, guys.
Yeah.
Other business before us, we will adjourn. Thank you, Paula.